People's Tribune Radio is on the air. I'm your host, Mike Thornton. On this special two-part edition of PTR, we bring you Howard Zinn.
And there's this assumption that there is a unity of interest in this country. And the language of the culture keeps assuming that and keeps impressing that on us. Because we use words that embrace us all. The nation, the country, America. No. So I am, from time to time, accused of castigating America because I've castigated Reagan or Clinton or somebody. And something, you mean they are America?
People's Tribune Radio is produced by the League of Revolutionaries for a New America, who also published the newspaper People's Tribune, Tribuno del Pueblo. Stay tuned for contact and ordering information at the end of the program. Nicole Trejo has the month off. In October 1998, Howard Zinn spoke on the topic of a working class citizen's economic bill of rights. Professor Zinn's speech was sponsored by the United Food and Commercial Workers Union, Local Number 7, in Denver, Colorado. We'd like to thank Roger Leisner of Radio Free Maine for providing us with Professor Zinn's talk. And now, part one of Howard Zinn's talk on a working class citizen's economic bill of rights.
I sort of feel there's not a lot I can tell this group, because I sort of, I look around and I see veteran organizers and people been working in the trade union movement, people on picket lines. Am I romanticizing? Am I exaggerating? That's what you look like to me. Hardened veterans of the labor movement. So I'll try not to talk too long, right? If I'm going to say things you already know, I may as well keep it short. And then we can have a discussion. You can ask questions, and I can answer anything, of course. And we'll take it from there. I said I would talk about an economic bill of rights, which seems like a good thing to talk about. Everybody knows we have a political bill of rights. And it's interesting that, you know, you go to school and you learn, you know, one of the great things about our democracy and the political structure in the United States and the Constitution is that we have a Bill of Rights. And I know it never occurred to me as I was learning this in school, and I don't think it occurs to most people who learn about the Bill of Rights. It never occurs to them and to us to think this Bill of Rights deals with political rights. It deals with the right of free speech and press and assembly and religion. It deals with the right to counsel and the right to trial by jury and all sorts of things like that. You know, the right against double jeopardy and the right not to testify against yourself and all of these sort of judicial civil liberties, political rights. And it never occurred to me to ask, how come there is nothing in the Bill of Rights which guarantees people the right to live? the right to health, the right to medical care. Why aren't people guaranteed the right to jobs if they want to work? Why aren't people guaranteed the right to decent housing, to care for their children? These would seem to be even more important than the right to trial by jury. A small number of us may come before juries. People like the ones in this room might be the kind of people who, but most people don't come before juries. But everybody has the problem of taking care of their health and of getting work and of making a decent wage. None of those things are in the Bill of Rights. But I guess it was also at a certain point that it occurred to me that even the political rights, which we are presumably guaranteed, don't mean very much without economic democracy. That is, for instance, the right of free speech. And on its face, it seems wonderful. Everybody has the right of free speech. And then when you begin to look into it, of course, you learn that there are little footnotes and considerations that make the right of free speech not as absolute as you think it is when you first read it in the Bill of Rights. I mean, of course, one of the things you learn is that your right of free speech is only guaranteed against governmental interference and not against private interference. So that private corporations can interfere with your right of free speech, and you have no constitutional right to challenge that. And then, for a very long time, until this century, even the right of free speech guaranteed against government only applied against the federal government, which meant that state governments could deprive you of freedom of speech up to the hilt, and you had no constitutional protection against that. And then, of course, when you think about the relationship between wealth in the Bill of Rights and the First Amendment of right of freedom of speech, and at a certain point in your life, it occurs to you that, yes, we all have the right of free speech, but some of us have more of a right than others. That is, some of us have a right to reach millions of people and speak freely to these millions of people. And others of us have the right to speak to 50 people or 100 people. And I remember, when we were kids, they said, well, anybody, this is what makes this a wonderful country, anybody can get up on a soapbox in Union Square. I don't know why they always picked on Union Square, but anybody in New York, anybody can get up on a soapbox in Union Square and say whatever he wants. Well, yes, you can get up on a soapbox and 50 people will hear you. But if you manufactured the soapbox, if you were Procter & Gamble, you could go on the air and reach a million people. And so freedom of speech is not just a quantitative, it's not just a qualitative thing, it's a quantitative thing. It's not just a matter of do you have free speech, it's a matter of how much free speech do you have. And then if you go down the list of other items, of course, in the political Bill of Rights, and you ask, and you begin to think about the how the distribution of wealth affects those, it's very startling to think that all of these so-called beautiful rights are all hedged in by the problem of economic injustice. And although everybody has the right to counsel, some people have the right to $1 million counsel, and other people have the right to a state-appointed counsel. I remember one time my students, I taught a course for years called Law and Justice in America. And the theme of the course, which could be summed up in one sentence, which students only had to attend the first 5 minutes of the course, then they could go home, was that there's a difference between law and justice. No. And difference between what the Constitution says on paper and what your rights are in reality. I remember some of my students, because my students, I'd always, instead of giving them exams, I'd have them go out into the city and explore things and write about what they saw, issues of law and justice. And I remember a number of my students went to court, and they watched the court-appointed attorneys when the court-appointed attorneys were meeting with their clients, the clients for whom they had just been appointed. And, right, the court-appointed attorney is appointed a client who is accused of a crime, goes over to the client, says, come out into the corridor with me, go out into the corridor, and my students timed the amount of time spent with a client before going in to argue the case. And the average time was 7 minutes. And I suppose part of the reason for not questioning this is that we don't like in this country, in the dominant culture, and that means in the educational system, and that means in the media, we don't really like to face the fact that we are a class society. Yes, Brazil, that's a class society, but not the United States of America. And not we the people of the United States got together and formed this Constitution. All of us together, the founding fathers and us, all of us got together, as if the founding fathers, were a multicultural group, And there's this assumption that there is a unity of interest in this country. And the language of the culture keeps assuming that and keeps impressing that on us. Because we use words that embrace us all. The nation, the country, America. No. So I am, from time to time, accused of castigating America. Because I've castigated Reagan. Or Clinton. Or somebody. And something, you mean they are America? You mean Congress is America? You mean the President? You mean the Supreme Court? You mean they are America? This failure to recognize class divisions in this country, you know, goes way, way back. And of course we've had class divisions in this country from the very moment that people arrived in this country, right? People didn't arrive. I remember going to school and thinking, I don't know what grade I was in then. I wouldn't like to think I was in graduate school and I was still ignorant. Although, in graduate school, I was still ignorant of a lot of things. I remember thinking, the people who came here, oh, they were the pilgrims. They were all the same. Look at the way they dressed. They all dressed the same way. They all talked the same way. I guess they were all of the same class. I guess the people who came here were all at about the same level. And somehow, in some mysterious way, soon, some of them turned up very rich, and others turned up as servants. A genetic problem. You know, who knows what. But then when, you know, when I began to look more closely at colonial history, you know, than reading the Reader's Digest, when I began to look at colonial history, and I thought, no, you know, some people came here to this country immediately with enormous grants of land. And other people came here with nothing. And other people came here as servants. And of course, other people came here as slaves. We had a class society right from the beginning. And the period in this country, before the American Revolution was not simply a period, and I remember what I got out of my education in elementary and junior high and high school, and even to a great extent in college, that whole period before the American Revolution was a period marked essentially by conflict between the colonists and England. But that wasn't so. That conflict between the colonists and England only developed really in the, you know, the last 10 years before the Revolution. Last 12 years before the Revolution. But before that, the major conflicts that took place in that long period from the beginning of the 17th century to the American Revolution, the major conflicts were class conflicts, were tenants rebelling against their landlords, food riots in Boston, flour riots, the storehouses of merchants being broken into by hungry people, governor's mansion being invaded and his wines taken out. Not a bad idea. But we don't talk about class in this country. I remember seeing a movie review in the Boston Globe, my hometown newspaper, movie review of a movie called Germinal. Some of you may know the novel by Emile Zola, Germinal, which is a very heavy, class-conscious novel about miners and their struggles. That was Germinal. And the French made a movie about it. I don't think Hollywood would make a movie about it. But the French made a movie about it. And the reviewer in the Boston Globe didn't like the movie. And At the end of the review, they always had this designation. They still have this designation, you know, for PG, PG-13, R, Q, Y, X, you know, those things, right? And if they said, if they had R, they explained why. No. And usually if it was R, it said, nudity, profanity, frontal nudity, rear nudity, some kind of nudity, and some kind of profanity, and, you know, to explain the R. And so they had, Germinal had R. And I had read the novel, and I hadn't seen the movie, but I thought, gee, I wonder what in that would produce that designation R. And the explanation was, this is an exact quote, unlike all the other things, this is a real exact quote. Depiction of intense suffering and class conflict. Really? I know, you don't believe it. Well, I didn't believe it when I read it. But, you know, you have to read the newspapers with an open mind. And, yeah, there it was. I remember Bush. Do you remember Bush? Yeah, Bush. I remember Bush in his campaign against Dukakis, accusing Dukakis. Do you remember Dukakis? Yes. Well, we in Massachusetts, we remember Dukakis. Dukakis. Bush was running against Dukakis, and Bush accused Dukakis of appealing to class hatred. This really surprised everybody in Massachusetts. I mean, we knew Dukakis. And the idea that Dukakis would appeal to class hatred was a little hard to accept. But that's... every once in a while you'll see one politician accusing another politician of appealing to sort of class antagonism, as if this is the most terrible thing in the world. I mean, obviously, what we desperately need in this country is a party that will appeal to class antagonism. But no, we don't have, we don't yet have that. No. But, so we have all these designations which try to unite a class society into one, a group with a common interest so that they can use words like national security, right? You know, as if, you know, well, all of our security is involved. And, I mean, they could say national securities. No, that would be more accurate. National interest. Well, I could talk about interest, you see, a different kind of interest. But when they say, oh, this is, and you see this, people up there in the high levels of politics have talked very sonorously about, well, we will have to do this if it is a matter of national interest. And I can just see, you know, a whole population of the country nodding their heads, well, yes, of course, you know, as if our interest is the same, you know, as the Secretary of Defense or the Joint Chiefs of Staff. But all of this language is a great cover for the class divisions in our society. And for the economy. The economy is a good example, right? The economy is in good shape. The economy is in bad shape. What do you mean by the economy? And who? Whose economy? Is it the economy the same for all of us? Does the Dow Jones average have the same meaning for everybody in the country? Are we all as fascinated by the ups and downs of the Dow Jones average, you know, as the people who own a million shares of Microsoft? If any of you read the novel Hard Times, there's this guy, a Dickensian character, Gradgrind is his name, and he's a teacher. What a teacher. teacher who believes in facts, facts, statistics, statistics, nothing but facts, you know. And his poor daughter has to live with this father, I started to say a caricature of a teacher, and sometimes I wonder, I don't like to think that he's not a caricature, but he actually represents a lot of real teachers. But his daughter has to, and he's telling his daughter, about how the life expectancy in this country is so-and-so. This is a statistic given by the assurance companies. And his daughter says, yes, but I'm interested in my life. And he can't grasp the fact that there are individual lives. He has a student in his class who's a working class girl who enters his class, she hears him saying that the wealth of England is £50 million, and aren't we all therefore I actually have this down here somewhere. I don't make everything up. Well, you could say, well, maybe I make it up and I write it down and I claim that I saw it somewhere. Gradgrind says in the class, in this nation there are 50 millions of money. Isn't that a prosperous nation? And aren't you in a thriving state? And the mill girl thinks about it and she answers, well, I don't know. I couldn't know whether it's a prosperous nation and whether I'm in a thriving state unless I know who has the money and whether any of it is mine. But she saw through what Kurt Vonnegut in one of his books called a grand falloon, a great big bubble which encompasses everything and therefore hides everything, and where you don't really know the reality until you puncture the bubble, you puncture the grand falloon. And that's what this mill girl was doing at this point. Because the reality is that it's a class economy in which 1% of the population has as much wealth as 95% of the population. This is something I guess, probably something you deal with every day when you're organizing, what's happened in this country. It's always been a class society. It's just gotten worse. There's always been a maldistribution of wealth, but the maldistribution of wealth has gotten worse. In 1980, the ratio of the salary of a CEO to a worker, to an average worker, was 40 to 1. Now it's 240 to 1. In the last 20 years, the wealth of the upper 1% has gone up by $1 trillion. The top 1% had $6 trillion, now they have $7 trillion. All they have to do is to tax that extra trillion. Right? Imagine what we could do in this country with $1 trillion. $1,000 billion. I have to keep reminding myself what a trillion is. $1,000 billion. Right? Of course, if we did that, they would cry. My God. There are all these realities that you know about the plight of children in this country and about how we compare to other countries. In this country, it's estimated 20 to 25% of children are below, the poverty line. And if you look at the same figures for, Finland and Sweden and Denmark, it's not 25%, but it's 3 or 4% of the children who are below the poverty line. If you look at the wages of the lowest 20% of the working class in the United States, the wages of the lowest 20% of people in Italy are higher than the wages of 20%, lowest 20% here in the United States. And remember, it wasn't so long ago that we thought, well, Italy is almost a third world country, right? And we are, of course, the greatest, most prosperous country in the world. I mean, but this to me is sort of the key to whatever organizing is going to go on around economic issues. And the key is that we are not a poor country. You know, that we are an immensely rich country, and this money is being wasted. This is money is going to the wrong things and to wrong people and the wrong places. And this enormous wealth in this country could be used rationally and humanely in such a way as to solve the problems that we could see everywhere in the country if our eyes weren't simply fixed on the Dow Jones average. The problems we would see if we simply walked from one end of a city to another. And that's all you would have to do in every city in this country in order to understand that this is a class society. Because if you live in just one part of the city and stay there, you can well believe everything is fine. The economy is healthy. We're doing well. But all you have to do is walk, really take a long walk. Sometimes it's a short walk from one end of the city to another. And then is it any wonder that people in New York City have to put five locks on their doors? If you walk from Harlem down to Fifth Avenue and see the way people live in one place and see where people live another. These are the realities, and this is the issue. And it's not a problem of the last 10 or 15 years, even though things have gotten worse. And therefore, perhaps because they've gotten worse, create a better opportunity to point it out. But it's a long-standing problem. It's a problem that goes way back, the maldistribution of wealth in this country. It's not just a problem that begins solved by the passage of this law and that law. It's a problem that would have to be solved by a very sweeping set of changes in the economic and social structure of the country.
That was part one of a special edition on this month's People's Tribune Radio, a talk by Howard Zinn on the topic of a working class citizen's economic bill of rights. We'd like to thank Roger Lasner of Radio Free Maine for bringing us this recording of Howard Zinn. People's Tribune Radio is produced by the League of Revolutionaries for a New America. If you'd like more information about the League, you can call 1-800-691-6888. That phone number, 1-800-691-6888. I'm your host, Mike Thornton. On behalf of Nicole Trejo and the League of Revolutionaries for a New America, we invite you to stay tuned for the next part of a talk by Howard Zinn on a special edition of People's Tribune Radio.